Chapter 27, Seeds and Not Decisions. When we stop and think carefully about this pen, I began, rolling it in my fingers, then it's very clear that what is its penness is not coming from itself, from its side. That much, if we are just honest with ourselves and think carefully for a few moments, is obvious. And I let him finish. Because if it were a pen by itself, from its own side, then every creature who ever came in contact with it would see it as a pen. It would, in a sense, be shouting out, "Pen!" to every being that ever looked at it. But it doesn't act that way, announcing itself like that, say to a cow or to a fly that lands on it, concluded the captain eloquently. Correct, I said. But the fact is that we people do see this, the green stick, as a pen, don't we? And if that's not coming from its side, then it must be coming from our side, he finished, almost impatiently. Where else could it come from? It has to be our own minds that make us see the green stick as a pen, and it must be the cow's mind making her see the same green stick as, well, as just something good to eat. And then he looked frustrated, as if he were about to burst, and I waited for the question that I knew was coming. "But there's a problem with that," he blurted out, "because it can't be, you see, that it's just my mind making me see it as a pen." "And why not?" I said. Cold as steel, the way Katrine would have said it. "Well, it's obvious," he steamed. "Completely obvious. If it really were just my mind making me see this as a pen, well, then I could just decide to see it any way I wanted and then see it differently. Like I could just decide to see the green stick as a bar of gold. And that's what it would be if it were just my own mind making me see it as a pen." I nodded. This was the usual way a person's thinking would flow once they started to get the idea. Well, the master answers that very question in the short book. He says, "Countless seeds within our minds make us see the great variety of things around us. Countless seeds within our minds make us see the great variety of things around us." The point is, I explained, that we don't have any choice about how our minds make us see something in this moment, because they force us to see it that way. Because our minds, you see, are full of millions and millions of tiny seeds planted long ago. And as we look at something, some of those old seeds that were planted there before, well, they ripen, and they make us see things the way we do, force us to see things the way we do. And so it is our minds that make us see things the way we do, but it's not at all that we are controlling the process instant by instant. And I think it might help you here if we say a little bit more about how it all happens, because it happens so fast, all just in one moment, always in the one fleeting present moment. The master goes on to explain it like this. "The way it works is that they organize other parts in a certain way. The way it works is that the seeds organize other parts in a certain way." You see, there are always some other parts involved. Let's take the pen in this case. The other parts are a cylindrical shape, some green color. In fact, if you think clearly about it, this is another indication that it's your mind that's making you see the pen a pen. The captain cocked his eye at the pen, trying to thresh it out, and I guided him ahead swiftly. You see, if you really think about it, our eyes, our sense of sight, it works in a very limited little world, that is, in shapes and colors. Your eyes, as such, can only detect light and shadow, shapes and colors. And once they have detected the shape and the color, in our case, cylindrical shape and some green color, then their only job is to pass that information along to the mind. And then the mind thinks about it and organizes all of this data into an object, into a thing. Now, which thing is decided, or which thing it decides to organize out of these parts, is not really up to us, you see, or things would always just be what we want them to be. And the hard facts of life inform us quite clearly that this is not the way it works, at least not always. No, it's different. Something else is at work. Something behind the scenes, something outside of our conscious control. And this power behind the scenes is the seeds within our minds, countless seeds, many layers. They decide how our mind goes ahead and organizes this input from the eyes, from the senses. A cow's mind has seeds that ripen in the moment and organize the reports of color and shape into an image of a tasty little morsel. Our minds have different seeds that ripen at the very same moment, but which organize the color and shapes into a pen. And why does the master say countless seeds? Why look around you? Gaze upon the incredible variety of things around you at any given moment, and all their detail, every little detail of the things you see around you. It has to be an image, a separate image organized by the mind, which is forced to do so as more seeds ripen to organize each detail into itself and the relationship between each detailed image. And that's just the things we can see, I pushed on. But everything else we can ever be aware of outside of us, inside our thoughts and memories, hopes and dreams and ideas, they are all the same. All of them images, all of them things sketched into being from other parts, other pieces put together with the seeds within our minds, forcing our minds to put them together. And all real, you see, this is real. I wanted to make sure right away that he didn't fall into the common trap. All real, you see, all working, really working, as the objects we see them to be. The pen is an object that the seeds in our mind force our minds to piece together. Yes, but the pen works, you see. It is real. It works. And that's exactly why it works. And for the same reason, that's why it works as something nice to eat for the cow, he finished with a smile. It may be true. Well, I guess it has to be true. That is only the seeds in the cow's mind making it see it as some green cylinder as a snack. But that doesn't make it any less real or tasty or solid in a cow's stomach. In fact, if I understand you right, it explains exactly why this cylinder can fill the cow's stomach. Beautiful, I whispered in hushed tones. Beautiful, you got it. He leaned over the desk at me, happy, and with every reason to be happy. No, I didn't get it, he whispered back with a smile. I frowned. Didn't get what? Didn't get where the seeds come from. Ah, that, I said. Later, we chorused. Time to knock on the pipes, I added. I was hoping you'd forgotten, he said, his face already dripping from the summer heat. Can't we just concentrate on cleaning the pipes from the inside today? Isn't it much more powerful that way, he asked. It is, I agreed. But working from the outside, the yoga poses, the special ways of breathing, it's something so concrete, something anyone, anywhere, at any age, in any frame of mind, can roll up their sleeves and get their bare hands on and make gradual, steady, measurable progress from day to day. And that, in and of itself, is powerful, unspeakably powerful. We need things like that. They go together, a perfect union, yoga. Inside and out. All right, he said with resignation and stood up to sweat some more. Chapter 28, Seeds Are Planted. The next class, we went straight to the point. It's best to do very important things as soon as you can, because the more important they are, the better the chances that something might happen to stop them. And this certainly turned out to be a day like that. So let's summarize where we are so far, I began. It's not the case that we see the pen as itself, as a pen, because it's a pen from its own side. Otherwise, Mr. Cow would have tried to write a letter with it, Mrs. Cow. But she didn't, did she? So it must be something in our own minds that makes us see the pen as a pen. And last week, we saw that how our minds organize things into things is not just something we consciously decide in the moment. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any problems in life, and we do, since we could just wish things into things we wanted, and we can't. And so there must be other forces at work, behind the scenes, forces beyond our current control. And the master said that these forces are seeds, certain seeds in our minds, ripening moment to moment and forcing our minds to organize bits and pieces of information into images, into things themselves. Small problem right there, interjected the captain, raising his hand, almost like a boy in a classroom. I knew what his problem was, but I let him go ahead and say it. He was such a wonderful student. He actually took things home and thought about them over and over until he came to the next logical question. "What's that?" I said, playing along. "I understand that there may be seeds in my mind that step into the act when I look at some cylinder-shaped patch of green and make me see it as a pen. But what about the green itself?" I said. "You tell me. There are people who can't see colors, you know, colorblind people. Same thing. No seeds. They don't have any seeds going off in their mind and organizing the other parts into a patch of color. And in this case, the other parts are the left side of the patch and the right side of the patch. Even colors and shapes are still just images pieced together by our minds." I paused. "Forced to do so by the seeds that are there, the seeds in each separate person's mind," he concluded. "But then why," he blurted out, "why do we see the same objects? Why do you and I both see this thing as a pen if the pen isn't coming from its own side?" "You tell me," I challenged him. He frowned and thought for a moment. "Same seeds? Similar seeds?" he asked. "Exactly," I said, "or nearly so. Of course, the two of us see, and that's why we see, the same pen in a slightly different way. But insofar as we both see a pen as well, we have the same kinds of seeds in our two minds. But now you must do as you promised," he said seriously, "and tell me, where do the seeds come from in the first place?" "Because," I prompted him. "Because," he said, gazing at something outside the window, something beyond the sky. Because if we've said it's true, if we are seeing this thing as a pen only because there are seeds in our minds that force us to see it as a pen, then if we could change the seeds, if we could affect those seeds, if we could cultivate certain seeds purposely, and destroy undesirable seeds purposely, then I don't see any reason why we couldn't eventually see, say it, I said. We'll see ourselves, see our very own bodies, our flesh and blood bodies, become light. Sort of the ultimate yoga pose, if you think about it. And then as well, we could turn the process further on the things around us. I mean, theoretically, if we have what we said, have said is true, and I see no reason why it isn't true, then we really could come to a place of perfect light, light ourselves, and be with all of those with whom we have suffered so far through this life, and all of them could also be the same, liberated, light. Perfect, I breathed. And so we must understand how the seeds work. And again, this is all part of the deeper yoga that the master has passed on to us so perfectly. And here he says, "The storehouse is planted by the things we do. The storehouse of seeds is planted by the things we do." When he says storehouse here, the master is talking about the storehouse in our own minds, the place where the seeds stay until they ripen and compel our minds to organize other parts into an image, into a thing. And he answers that most important question. He tells us where the seeds come from by saying that they are planted by the things we do. And if you think about it, it makes sense on a very basic level. Something has to have put all these seeds in our minds. And this is obviously not the kind of thing where someone can come along and get, say, a handful of beans into your mind by pouring them into one of your ears. If the seeds ripen as perceptions, as something mental, then it makes sense that they were planted by mental perceptions in the first place. And what the master is saying is that we plant these seeds every time we perceive ourselves do something, anything. The captain made that frown of his again and then said, but anytime we do something, whenever we do anything, well, of course we perceive ourselves doing it. We see ourselves doing it on some level. Exactly so, I said. And so everything we ever do, any action we ever take, any word we ever utter, even the very thoughts we think, they all plant seeds in our minds. Simply as we are aware in any way that we are doing them. Seeing ourselves do them plants a seed, makes us imprint on the mind something new, like pressing your hand into a lump of clay. And the actions or the words or the thoughts, they may stop and we may go on to something else, but the imprint remains. The imprint made on our minds, it stays there. It becomes a seed that will determine how we see the world later on. And so now let's take a real example. Let's say you're walking down the road out there and you see a man who said something unpleasant to you a few days before. And so you make up some excuse to hit him with your policeman's stick on the back. In the very moment that you decide to hit him, a thought flashes through your mind. You have a picture, a vague picture perhaps, of him holding his back in pain just after you hit him. And then you do hit him. You see yourself actually doing it. And you see a much clearer image of his pain with your own eyes. And then perhaps on the way back to the station, you think with satisfaction about how you got back at him for that thing he did. In your mind's eye, you see yourself again hitting him and him in pain. Each time the pain is anticipated or actually seen or reflected upon later, well, then an imprint is placed in your mind, like a handprint left in soft clay. And this imprint, an imprint of pain that you have caused in someone else's back, it stays there. It becomes a seed. And then one day, your mind goes to some other parts. I paused to see if he could pick up the thread. He hesitated, but then it came to him. Other parts, say like the bones in the lower part of my spine. And the seed ripens just then. The image of pain planted in the clay comes to the front of the mind and I'm sitting at my desk, hunched over an important report in the middle of the eighth year of my service here, and suddenly my mind makes me feel, he paused, he got it. I mean the seeds in my mind, they ripen, and that imprint, that old image of pain in the area of the back that was planted when I saw myself cause someone else pain, it comes back to me, to myself, making me feel the very same pain. And his hand went instinctively to his back. Then he stopped, and I could see the ideas begin to pour through his mind. And he said excitedly, you know, it makes sense. I mean, you know, I'd always heard about this kind of idea. I mean, people all the time are talking about how what you do comes back to you. But we never take that seriously because it wasn't very clear how it all worked, really. I mean, you think about it and it seems to make sense. It would be a perfect kind of justice in the entire universe, really, if what you did to others always came back to you. And if looking at it the other way around, everything that ever happens to us only happens to us because we have done the same thing to someone else. But until you explained it to me that way you did, I mean, starting with the pen you see and the cow and really proving to me beyond any argument that it must be something in my own mind that makes me see it as a pen. Well, until then, this idea of sort of inescapable justice on a grand scale was just something that sounded like it should exist rather than something that does exist. Something that does exist and dictates, well, then, every single detail of our lives, every single detail of the world around us. "It is so pure," he said, looking into my eyes with a kind of reverence, "and it's so overwhelming." He moved his hand up to his forehead and rubbed it the way he used to rub his back. "A lot of questions," he said then. "The more the better," I answered. "It's the only way to learn," but it still didn't get him out of his poses. That night, I was fast asleep when a sound outside the bars of my cell woke me. I thought it was some terrible dream, some memory of what had happened before. But it was terribly real, and now. It was the sergeant again, hanging onto the bars with his hands, his eyes drunk and gleaming, red once again, and the stink of the liquor filling the late night air. "You will come with me," he said. And without a question, I knew he meant it. Deadly serious this time. He had gotten another stick somewhere, and he cracked it against the bamboo bars, and he lifted the crossbar free of the door. "Ravi! Ravi, what are you doing now?" came Busuku's sleepy voice. "Shut up, Busuku," roared the sergeant, and I heard the stick flail down the line of the bars on the other side and a sharp cry as it struck Busuku's knuckles. "Ravi!" he called again in a warning of his own. "Nothing to worry about this time anyway, Busuku, and I tell you the truth." The sergeant stood tall, weaving inside the cell now, and he said to the wall there, to the dead dusty wall, because I am taking her to see the boy." He said it simply, but with so much pain that it hurt my own heart to hear it. Busuku went silent then, totally silent, and I felt that it meant I should go with the sergeant. And so I did, through the darkness, following the dark form, and the sound of the stick dragging useless on the ground, and the sickening smell of liquor. We went a fairly long way out near the old woman's house and then beyond, up a small road into a small yard that spoke of ruin and neglect, into a dark room where his smell had been so often, so long, that every article in the room seemed soaked with it. And there was a small figure in a small hearth, just for the light, and a small figure, a child, hunched before the flame in a blanket with his back to me. Near the door was a single bare table with a single candle, and sitting on a mat behind it was a woman, an old woman. I studied her face in silence. It was creased deeply with a lifetime's lines of pain, and the white scars around her eyes and the lips, all framed in a shock of white hair. And then I suddenly realized that she was the sergeant's wife, and I saw all the beginnings, all the beatings she had lived through, and I saw in her eyes the undefeated kindness that so often grows within a person subjected to the worst and daily pain. And she smiled softly and said, "Please excuse my husband," without even saying it. Not saying it, it said to me that she would be beaten again if it were said out loud. And we understood each other fully in that moment, and I nodded, and she nodded back ever so slightly. And then the sergeant and I sat at the table, and the kind woman pushed me a little cup of warm, simple tea, and the sergeant pulled a clay jug from under the table and took a deep drink, and then fixed those angry, crimson eyes on my own. "I was drunk," he said, and he drank again. "Got drunk with the captain like we used to do." He paused and drank again. "I came home and they were sleeping, she and the boy," and he waved the jug toward the figure sitting at the fireplace. He lifted it to his lips again, but then simply set it down on the table. He stared at me, his face twisted, and tears sprang out. "I knocked over a candle like this one. And he stared into the small flame, and jagged lines of tears inched down his face. The woman looked away. The straw, you see, they were sleeping on it. Some straw, you see, and it caught fire, and at first I didn't notice, too drunk to notice. And then they were screaming, she and the boy screaming, and the flames are up in my face, and I don't know what to do, I don't know what I'm doing. But I tell myself, I say, Ravi, you are an officer of the realm, and you're trained in the Royal Academy, and you know how to act, and you know when to act, and so now just carry out your duty as you have been trained to do. And I calm myself, and I reach into the flames, and I feel the two arms, and I grab onto them with all my might, and I tear us out of the fire and from the house, kicking and screaming, and then outside, and I'm wondering why all the kicking and screaming. And I looked down into my hands and my arms, my hands, and closed like still vices, and the woman cried out in pain despite herself. And you see, it was only her two arms. I'm holding only her two arms. And then finally I can hear she is screaming. She is screaming, the boy, the boy. Boy, he suddenly explodes. Boy, get up, come here. And the little blanket at the fireside stirred and stood slowly, stiffly, and the boy came to the table, and his face came into the light. What I saw first was the kindness and softness of his eyes. Love. As if he had never lived in this house with this man turned demon. And as if he had never seen the reflection of his own face. And the face I saw then, it was slick and red on one side, as if it were wax, wax that had melted and fallen into his neck, glued there now in a web of angry skin. I started to cry, despite myself, not at his ruined face, but at the pain he must have had and the pain he has now, underneath his obvious courage. The sergeant sat for a moment studying the same face, crying steadily, and he reached out and held what remained of the cheek and said, only, my boy, in a voice of love and pain. And then he turned to me and said, can you fix him? Can you fix something like this? Like you fixed the captain's back? The woman moaned at her husband's impossible hope. He didn't even hear it. And his leg, he went on excitedly. His leg, you see, boy, walk over to the fire. Show her your leg. And with unspeakable, unfathomable cheerfulness, the boy looked up into my eyes warmly and turned and dragged himself to the fire, one leg flopping weakly and then back again. And he looked up again at me, not really hoping, but just because of the love in him, the love for anyone. And Katrin came back into me, and I was sitting with the captain holding up that glorious pen of truth between us, and I turned to the sergeant and his wife, and I said, anything is possible. And then I am outside the doorway of the dark house. But now the moon is out, and the sergeant is looking into my face, and I into his, and I say, but there is one condition. Anything, he says. You must come to learn as well. You must be cured as well. He shook his head sadly. The sickness I have cannot be cured. It stops, and then comes back. You cannot ask me for that. I cannot learn it, even from you. I shook my head resolutely in the dark. You can learn, and you must learn, and not from me. He looked down, puzzled. You will learn from the captain. He opened his mouth to object. It's not for you, I hissed. It's for him. For the captain. And you will do it, or the boy remains as he is. I stood there in the pale light, with his mouth still open, and then he closed it softly and nodded quietly and brought me back to the jail. Chapter 29, The First Question. Problems, boomed the captain. All kinds of problems. The minute you go back to your cell, all these problems come up, and I have to live with them for a whole week. I smiled. The great teachers like my uncle back home or Katrin, they love it when their students come back with problems about what they have taught them. It shows, first of all, that they were listening, and secondly, that they're thinking. Go ahead, I said. Let's start with them.
but one at a time, please, clearly stated. He did that little frown and then went on with an excitement that was lovely to see. I mean, I've got these questions, lots of them, but how about just one obvious one first? I mean, he paused so he could say it right. I had that bad back for years and years and years before you fixed it with the yoga. And then suddenly he got stuck even before he had reached where he'd gotten stuck. With the yoga, it became a question now. I mean, did you fix my back with the yoga, or did I just start seeing it differently as a fixed back rather than a hurt back? Because maybe the old seeds wore out and some new seeds opened up? It's a good question, I said first. And one of the most important you could ask. And you have to buckle down and listen carefully if you really want to catch the answer. His little frown deepened into a positive scowl of concentration. I put my hand up to my face, middle finger between my eyebrows, thumb and pinky in the corners of my mouth, and pushed gently up. He gave a little laugh and loosened up his face, which had the effect of making his concentration even deeper. How your back got fixed was that you did yoga. Why the yoga worked for you was that, yes, different seeds in your mind begin to assert themselves, and old ones wore out. So what you're saying, he said, is that at some point in the past, I did something like, say, hit someone in the back. He gazed up at the ceiling, calculating, and then back down at me with a tinge of embarrassment. Or maybe you could say, maybe I did it a few times. Perhaps, I allowed. And then at some point, the seeds I planted then, they ripened in my mind, and the images I had in my mind as I hurt someone's back, they come back in my mind as my mind forces me to see my own back as hurting, the same way my mind makes me see the green stick as a pen, and the cow's mind makes her see it and use it, I added, see it and use it as something good to eat. So far, so good, I said. And then, after a while, those seeds, those bad seeds, I guess, they start to get old, they start to wear out. As do all things, I added, while they do what they do. The energy they have to do anything to us or for us wears out, simply as they do it. And I nodded him to continue. And then, say, some other seeds that have been sleeping there in my mind, they wake up. They take over creating images. The things, I added. The images, the very things that I see. In this case, the new seeds, they make me see my back as cured. See and be cured, I added. He nodded. And these new seeds, if there's any justice in the world, and you give me real hope now that there is justice in the world, well, I suppose they must have been planted earlier in my life at some point when I did something and watched yourself do something, I added. Oh, yes, he exclaimed. Got to get that imprint in the mind, right? And so these new seeds must have been planted when I watched myself do something like, say, help a sick person, help someone in pain. Exactly, I said, again in admiration of his instincts. Which brings me to a question, he rattled on. I mean, if it was the seeds in my own mind that made me see my back get better, made it be better, I said, then why do the yoga at all? He beamed with a glance to the center of the room, and it really was such a muggy day, I couldn't blame him. Listen carefully, I said. The yoga made your back get better. It wouldn't have made your back get better if you hadn't had the seeds in your mind to see it get better. You were ready. The same seeds that made your back get better were the ones that made you try the yoga. Made you attracted to it in the first place, made you think it might work, made me walk into your office that day, made the master's book lie in my bag, made the poses and the sitting loosen the knots in your channels. Do you see? He looked up at the ceiling for a quiet moment. It hadn't quite arrived, but he was close. But if I had never tried the yoga, he pressed on, those new seeds, the seeds to see myself get better, well, they still would have opened. They still would have made my back get better somehow. Not the point, I said softly. Think hard. Think carefully. The fact is they did open when the yoga came to you and when the yoga fixed you. They made the yoga and what the yoga did for you. You had to do the yoga because you did the yoga. He looked at me steadily, really, really trying hard to work it out. It will come, I said. And I'll tell you something. It helps a lot at this stage if you really ask all the teachers you see, your own teacher, your teacher's teacher, and so on, all the way back to Patanjali and long before him, ask them also to help you. Ask them to come in on their own invisible, untouchable way and help you. Help you understand, and they will. I paused so it would sink in, and then I said, you haven't actually got to your first question, you know, I said with a smile. Yes, he said, coming back to himself. He drew himself up like a real captain and then proclaimed, there's a problem with what you said before. I mean, I smiled, wondering how many problems he'd find with these latest ideas. What I mean is, well, let's say there really is some kind of justice. I mean, some kind of justice on a grand scale. And he waved his arms around big to encompass not just the old mud jail, but the entire universe. Well, then, first of all, since my back hurt me for more than 5 years, and if according to what you say, some kind of seeds in my mind make me see it that way all the time, the way you see it, the pen, the same way you see the pen, I nodded at the poor little stick to remind him that we had both already agreed on that point. Well, yes, okay, the way I see the pen. But anyway, that means that I must have beaten people on the back nonstop for 5 whole years, whereas, he gazed up at the ceiling calculating, whereas I never did any such thing. I mean, never for any period of time, not even remotely. He glared up and calculated the years with the sergeant cleaning up the gangs. I thought they must have been something. Even remotely, he repeated with confidence, approaching 5 years in a row. So there seems to be a problem with the seeds, he concluded. Ah, I said, seeds. We need to talk about seeds. We need to talk about how seeds work, I said. There is a short list of rules that govern how these seeds in our minds work. Just as there are laws of nature that govern how, say, corn seeds work. We'll cover them today. It's not much, really. The master opens the conversation with the first and most important rule of all. He says, there is a connection of cause and effect. The seeds ripen into experiences refreshingly pleasant or painful in their torment, depending on whether we have done good to others or done them wrong instead. And so the first rule of seeds, it's something you would guess, something you did guess already. If there really is sort of a huge perfect justice in the world, and it's that when you do any action at all that hurts someone, then a seed is planted in your mind, which will ripen later on to make you see something unpleasant. And when it ripens, cause you to have a painful experience. Equally so, whenever you do anything that helps someone, a seed is planted in your mind that will ripen and make you see something pleasant, an enjoyable experience. And remember that these seeds, again, are planted simply by being aware of yourself doing, saying, or even thinking something which is positive or negative. I got that part, he said a little impatiently. That's the whole attraction of this way of viewing the world, that bad things you do come back to you as pain and good things you do come back to you as pleasant experience because of a sort of universal law that's as simple and airtight as, say, the law of gravity. And that thing about how seeing yourself do something presses an imprint into the mind, that's great. That goes a long way in making me believe the whole thing. But again, why 5 entire years of back pain when I never did anything like that to anyone? First things first, I cautioned him. Now, this first rule of how it all works says that nothing can ever happen otherwise, meaning you can never expect a pleasant experience to develop from a negative action that you've done, and never an unpleasant experience from a positive action you've done. I paused to let it sink in. and for everyone's automatic reaction to this idea to surface to his mind. The captain frowned a bit, didn't catch himself, and then blurted out, "Problem right there, too. Problem with that first rule. Before you even got to my question, I mean, what about all the things that people do that make other things happen at all? And which obviously break this first rule of yours." "Like what?" I challenged him. The captain glanced up at the ceiling. "Well, just about everything, really. It's so obvious, but all right, let's start with a simple one. You sit in your cell for 3 days and weave a nice Tibetan rug. The sergeant takes it to town to market, to one of the little trading stalls. He meets the owner and they begin to haggle over the price of the rug. At some point in the conversation, the sergeant claims the rug is worth double what he's been offered. And it doesn't matter what he's been offered because he'll always say it. It's worth double that much. And he explains with a straight face that it took his sister 3 weeks to weave this extraordinary rug. And there's no way he can take less money for it. Or she and her child, I suppose that's your dog he's talking about, will surely die from hunger." I smiled. "And so?" "And so it works. You see, the lie works, and the man gives the sergeant the full amount he was asking for. And there you have it. The first rule of seeds is broken already. A lie produces a wonderful profit. And so it's not true that a negative action can only produce unpleasant results." "Unless you find extra money unpleasant," he mused quizzically, and shook his head. "No, no, can't say that the sergeant would find extra money a problem at all." But then he looked up at me, dead serious, for the answer. "It's still not your first question," I laughed, and he nodded, but we both knew it had to be answered. "And so, I give you the answer. The sacred answer to a question that has bothered all humankind for time with no beginning. How can an action which is clearly wrong have a desirable result? How can something like a shameless lie bring a person extra profit? The answer is, you see, that the first rule is not broken. Extra money, for example, comes from an imprint that was planted in the past. Seeds don't ripen instantaneously. The extra money comes from an imprint that was planted in the past when the person involved, here the sergeant, was generous and giving to someone else. During the course of his discussion at the market, this seed ripens and forces his mind to interpret some heavy circular objects as silver coins being pressed into his hand by the person who bought the rug. At the same time, the sergeant has just pressed new imprints into his own mind from his negative act of lying to someone else. At some point later on, these new seeds will ripen inside his own mind, and he will experience an assortment of various sounds and tones coming out of someone else's mouth as a pack of lies meant to mislead him. What I mean to say, my dear captain, and here I drew myself up very tall the way Katrin used to do at these crossroads of elegant truth, what I mean to say is, telling a lie had absolutely nothing to do with Sergeant getting the extra money. The captain just stared at me, blinking only once over the next 2 minutes, paused in perfect silence, and then he stirred himself. "But that's impossible, you see," he whispered. "Impossible, utterly impossible. Why, if what you just said is true, then almost every single action undertaken by the millions upon millions of people in the entire world from hour to hour throughout their entire lifetime, doesn't it all bring them the things that they thought those actions did bring them? It's impossible. That's too much. How could everyone be so wrong about how things work?" "Perhaps," I answered softly, looking out the window, "perhaps somewhere in there lies the clue to why all of us end up losing everything in the end." And we never did reach his first question on that day, but we did do the poses and sitting down to give and take, planting the real causes.